Hello and welcome to the Friday, March 15th, 2024 edition of the Sands and its Storm Centers Stormcast. My name is Johannes Ulrich and today I'm recording from Jacksonville, Florida. We do have a diary today by Jan looking at a couple different options that are increasing in how attackers are storing assets for their phishing scams. And these two are IPFS and R2. Both of them have been going around for a while, but keep increasing. IPFS, that's short for the Interplanetary File System, Distributed Web3 Storage System, and then R2, which is object storage provided by Cloudflare. Either of them can be used free or really cheap, so attackers are using it for ephemeral storage. Often these URLs are rotating very quickly. By the time you noted a particular URL or blocked a URL, well, it's already gone and moved to somewhere else. IPFS is something that you may want to consider blocking wholesale. I don't really see it used much sort of for real stuff. Of course, that's much more difficult for Cloudflare. R2 is commonly used by a number of valid applications and companies. R2.dev is the domain associated with it. So you may want to keep an eye out for these URLs. But like I said, wouldn't recommend blocking them. And we have, yet again, updates for Fortinet users. First one is not so good news, and that's new vulnerabilities, this time in FortiWLM. FortiWLM, that's their wireless LAN manager. Horizon 3 published a blog post with details regarding four different vulnerabilities. One is an unauthenticated command injection. We have unauthenticated SQL injection, unauthenticated arbitrary file read, and lastly, an authenticated command injection. Bad news here is that at least two of these vulnerabilities have not yet been patched. Horizon 3 originally reported these vulnerabilities to Fortinet back in May last year. And now after their 307 days of notification expired, they did publish the details regarding these vulnerabilities. Yesterday, I mentioned vulnerabilities in the FortiClient EMS. This particular vulnerability is, of course, patched. There is now on GitHub someone advertising for sale an exploit. I doubt it's real. We haven't, as of earlier today, not seen any actual exploitation yet. However, Horizon 3 also announced that next week they will do a blog post with all the details. So this is certainly something that you need to address before this weekend. Again, that's FortiClient EMS. FortiClient EMS is sometimes exposed to the internet, not really all that common, but certainly out there. The good news with the wireless LAN manager is that, at least according to Horizon 3, they only saw a couple instances being exposed to the internet. And by a couple, I mean, I think it was less than 10. And if you aren't busy enough patching Fortinet, another set of devices that you absolutely need to patch quickly is the ArcSurf UDP, the Unified Data Protection software. We have a blog post from Tenable releasing details regarding three different vulnerabilities that were just patched. And yes, the release does include a proof of concept exploit. The problem here is also that we have two different vulnerabilities that really can be chained for complete system compromise. One is an authentication bypass, so that's how the attacker originally gets access, and then can execute using the path traversal vulnerability any action as that user where they bypassed authentication for. So this means these two vulnerabilities together give you full system access. The interesting thing about the authentication bypass is that essentially an attacker just needs to send a request without password, and that will get the attacker authenticated. Well, it's a Friday again. I do have with me another sans.edu student, Michael Holcomb. Could you introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, I'm Michael, or Mike Holcomb. I currently am the floor fellow at, as you might imagine, Floor. We're one of the world's largest engineering and construction companies. So I'm very fortunate in my role to help also lead the control system cybersecurity practice. So I get to work with some of the best engineers in the world on some of the largest projects in the world. So I can hopefully was able to bring that experience to the work through SANS and the different courses that I took and the thesis, of course.
Yeah, and your paper, I really liked it. And you already mentioned that you're sort of in the industrial control space. Usually when you think about construction and such, you think about, you know, big excavators and such and people with lots of muscles kind of moving heavy stuff around. It's not sort of, we usually expect IT, but of course, IT is everywhere, data is everywhere. Can you explain a little bit what your paper was about?
Yeah, my paper kind of really went to focus on one item and kind of came up with two that I like to, two different, I guess, findings that I like to focus on. You know, in general, in ICS or OT environments, there's kind of this understanding that when you look at what we call PLCs or programmable logic controllers, these are the main, if you want, specialized computers we have in OT or critical infrastructure environments. So if I have, let's say, a power plant, and in that power plant, you know, I have turbines that turn, and in turn, those will turn a generator that creates electricity. Those systems are controlled by these PLCs. It's just like the thermostat in your house. You know, the thermostat's set to a specific degree, and it does a job where it's programmed that, if it gets too warm, you know, past where you set the temperature to be, it sends a signal out a little wire to your air conditioning unit to turn on the air and cool down the room. It will then continually take the temperature, realizes, the room is back to normal, you know, the normal temperature that we've set. It sends another signal. Okay, we'll turn off the air conditioner. That's an example of a PLC. So whether it's at home or in a power plant, it's essentially the same thing. And so with PLCs, we've had a few incidents over the years, and the one I think most people like to highlight is the Trident or Trisys incident. I was actually taking Rob Lee Sands' course, the grid course, during Trisys. So he actually had his Dragos team on the ground doing the investigation and the response while this was happening. So this was probably the best thing that ever happened for my ICS OT career. You can't pay for that type of kind of experience and being able to get kind of that play-by-play from Rob a little bit behind the scenes. So it was really exciting. But with Trident or Trisys, that's where the Russian nation state had come into a petrochemical facility owned and operated by Saudi Aramco. And in that case, the attackers were in the environment for months, if not years, and we're able to get to what they call the SIS, which is a set of other controllers like the PLCs. And so in that situation, and this is kind of where at least I see it across the industry, there people believe that if you set those controllers or PLCs to what they call run mode, that an attacker is not able to remotely manipulate the system. So they couldn't, you know, in the home example, they can't, you know, turn your air conditioner down to 60 degrees while you're on vacation in the middle of the summer. Or in the power plant example, right, they couldn't, let's say, shut down the power plant. And so there's this idea that you want to keep all of your controllers and systems in run mode. And what there is in, I always say, more expensive models, right? That of these types of systems, there's a physical key switch that you would put into these systems and you would turn into run mode. And people think of that as kind of like read-only mode. So I can pull information from that system, but I can't change the programming and I can't update or upload a new firmware that could potentially have malicious code built into it. So, and in the example of the Trident incident. And that's true on those nice expensive models, that if you had your key switch in run mode, that an attacker wouldn't be able to remotely manipulate that system. I think where I came from, looking at, you know, most environments out there, most OT environments, they're not those larger environments with the more expensive types of systems. They, you know, they don't need those. They're, you know, small manufacturing facilities. They're water treatment, right, and wastewater and rail and mines. And so a lot of those PLCs and other controllers we see out there, they don't have a physical key switch to even monitor. Most of them might have like a little dip switch, or they don't have any type of switch at all. And it's all controlled through software remotely. So that's always another way for attackers to be able to slip in. And so again, going back to, I guess the original question where the research was going was looking at, you know, with PLCs and just controllers in general, you know, looking at that, the key switch in general, which allows us to control, again, whether it's in run mode or what they call the operational mode. So is it in run mode, or is it in different controllers, call them, you know, have different modes and call them different things. So most will have two modes. So you have, you know, run or read only mode if you want. And then the others might have stop mode, or they might call it program mode. And then you have a couple other variations, but there's always those two modes. And so a lot of people, again, in the industry say, keep it in run mode, and then you're protected. Well, what I found is doing the research in a couple of PLCs that I had others, but I ran out of room in the paper. But the idea is, you know, I would have PLCs in run mode. These are PLCs that are commonly used in like manufacturing, especially in North America. And I would be in run mode, and I would go to make a change to the PLC programming code, and it would actually let you. It would ask you, hey, you're in run mode and you want to make a change to the PLC programming. Are you sure you want to do this? And you'd be like, yes. And it's like, okay, we'll let you make the change. So it wasn't stopping me from making a change to the programming code while it was in run, or again, what people think of as read-only mode.
Is it more that this run mode feature is not so much a security feature? It's really more sort of performance, that, you know, these PLCs are very time critical, and so you basically want to protect the CPU resources that they're dedicated to actually running the code versus worrying about updates.
I think that's a big part of it. Like you point out, it's not meant as a security feature. Mm-hmm. I think from a security perspective, what I did see, at least with the models that I tested, was that if you were in run mode, that it, while you could make PLC programming changes, you weren't able to upgrade or upload a new piece of firmware. So there is that, if you want, level of security. So there is some benefit. It's just not as much as a lot of people assume, I think, in the industry. And then the other piece was, people not understanding a lot of the more commonly used, I think, PLCs out there, they don't have key switches, right? And the environments don't have those more expensive models. They have these smaller models that they can afford, and that's all they need. And so the other idea was, we understand there's still some benefit of making sure that the PLCs stay in run mode. And that if they ever come out of run mode, it means ideally somebody's doing maintenance in an authorized change window, and that's great. Or what if it is an attacker, right? It's going to be rare, but it could happen. And so then part of the rest of the research was putting together essentially a little web app to monitor different PLCs, and different PLCs communicate and share that operational mode information differently. But for these two PLCs, to understand, it was a Click PLC and a Allen Bradley Rockwell Automation Micrologics A20, right? To be able to remotely determine what state they're in, and then if any of those PLCs ever comes out of run mode, then it sends the operator an alert to tell them they need to investigate. Okay. Unless it's, you know, they can say, oh, it's an authorized change window, great. You know, we can move on. The technician's doing their work. But then, oh, what if it's not an authorized change window? Then, well, someone's either doing something that they're not, right? And maybe it's just a technician that's doing work outside of a change window. Maybe it is an attacker. Or more than likely, it's probably some type of operational issue that they need to respond to and address. Maybe the PLC is having issues, and maybe it needs to be replaced. But for whatever reason, if that PLC comes out of run mode, they need to investigate. So there are solutions out there that monitor for the key switch position, which again is great if you have key switches, but a lot of environments don't. So it's, you know, you can just monitor for if it comes out of run mode in general, and then go into investigation mode.
Yeah, and I thought that part was really interesting about the paper. You sort of reverse engineered a little bit of protocol and, you know, how you can actually remotely figure out whether or not or what mode the device is in. One quick question about that key switch and dip switch and such.
Yeah.
Does it actually make sense to have that physical switch and have that in run mode if you also need to regularly update the firmware on these devices? Like, would this require someone crawling across the factory or the power plant to set all the switches, then you apply the update, and then you have to go back? Is this sort of a feasible operating model? Or?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So firmware in OT environments, in power plants and railways and mines, et cetera, they don't get updated that often. It's very rare for them. You might go years without them being updated. So you'll have PLC programming changes more often than you would have firmware upgrades. You know, the firmware upgrades themselves, it's, you know, unless there's some significant operational gain or security issue, but almost it's going to be an operational gain that you would do that upgrade. So we don't often see upgrades performed for security reasons in OT environments. And we usually say, you know, with PLCs, that's good enough. I always hate that phrase, but it's good enough security because those PLCs are so deep within the OT network that it takes time for an attacker to get there. And then ideally in a perfect world, right, which we know doesn't exist, but you're doing incident detection and you're able to find the attacker before they even get to the PLC, which I think as Rob Lee had just pointed out, that less than 5% of OT environments globally are doing incident detection. So that kind of gives you a little bit of that picture that, that's a whole other story. that's a whole book, I guess. All right.
But your script basically is sort of a very first step in incident detection. Hey, let's at least check if someone is changing the mode on these devices. We are not necessarily going to worry about checksums of code running on the devices or things like this, but just if an attacker is hitting us, they're probably going to try to put these devices into programming mode to get some more persistent exploit going, or
to be able to make changes. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of great platforms out there, but they also cost a lot of money. So the environments that have these kind of, I guess, if you want to say entry level PLCs, they're not going to have the money to go buy those platforms. So I think it's just, you know, it was just demonstrating, here's, you can create these tools. I created everything with ChatGPT. I realized, you know, I've always tried to be a developer. I finally realized that that's just not me. And so I had a lot of fun actually playing with ChatGPT to create these Python scripts. Mm-hmm. And even generate the web page and do a Flask little web app. And it was super easy. It was scary, you know, how easy it was to create these scripts with ChatGPT and sending specific broadcast packets with specific payloads and you know, being able to parse the return responses to understand what it's seeing. It literally didn't take much time or effort at all. So
that's great. I still have to look at the source code for security vulnerabilities. Not that the web app has new issues.
Well, yeah, and then you could ask ChatGPT, right, to find, are there any, you know, security vulnerabilities in the script? And it can kind of, from what I've, you know, heard, it can kind of find issues. It's not
perfect. I did some experiments and found that ChatGPT is better from a security point of view than Stack Overflow. So
yes, I'm sure anything is better, right?
Anyway, sure. Thanks. A link to the paper will be in the show notes. So if anybody's interested, I think the entire escapee stuff, there's a ton of stuff in this paper. Great work here, Michael. And yeah, thanks for joining me here. And that's it for today. Thanks for listening. Thanks to everybody who's recommending this podcast, leaving us good reviews, and doing anything to get us a couple more listeners. Thanks, and talk to you again on Monday. Bye.